Pulp Act Human, a podcast where we tell the everyday stories of digital specialists working on extraordinary projects. I'm Adobia Thatchell, a product manager here at the Department for Education. In a moment, I'm going to introduce you to our first guest, but let's dig in a little bit more into why we're doing this podcast, what the concept is. Well, every day, millions of pupils, teachers, frontline workers, and educational professionals are affected by the work we're doing in the background here at DfE Digital and Technology. And our work is centered around these users. But who are the people making it all happen? And what drives them to do it? What are the stories behind the user stories? Well, this series will shine a light on the human stories behind our digital projects, the stories behind transformational work, and the skills and attitudes our people bring to and take from their work. So absolutely no pressure then to our first guest, Emma Stace, the Chief Digital and Technology Officer. Welcome, Emma.
Hi.
Can you tell us a bit more about what exactly does a Chief Digital and Technology Officer do?
Okay, that's a big question. I think I'm still trying to work it out. What do I do? I would say that most of my work is about people and very little of it is actually about technology. So as the leader of digital and technology, my role is focused on making sure that our work impacts the people we're here to serve, children and learners, and also create the environment in which all of our people working across digital and technology can do excellent work to deliver value to those children and learners. So, you know, most of my day is focused on people.
So, full disclosure to our listeners, I am actually pretty brand new at the department and in the civil service completely. So, as I understand it, this group we're talking about today didn't even really exist 5 years ago. We're going to dig into that. We're going to find out what it is you've been up to over the last 4 years or so. And we're also going to talk about the DfE Digital and Technology merger and what your plans are for the future. But first, I have to know, like, what was your journey? How did you get here? Who is Emma Stace?
There are no simple questions on this podcast.
I'm going to need to know the meaning of life at the end of the disaster as well.
I'll try and figure that out as we go along. So who am I? In terms of the real basics, I have three children, one beautiful child from my first marriage, Kieran, two children from my second marriage. I am the daughter of a civil servant. I traveled the world with my father growing up. I went to American schools. I went to boarding school at 13 while my parents were living in India. And then I married an Indian and lived in South Africa for a while. So my lifestyle and my background have been very nomadic. And I arrived back in the UK about 10 years ago. And I'm determined that I'm never to leave. I like being settled finally in my life and in my work. I think those experiences are pretty formative in terms of how I got to where I am today. My father instilled in me the values of public service and of thinking about others and dedicating your life toward others. He always tells the story of leaving LSE with a doctorate when he was 24 and he went to Unilever and they were offering him lots of money and big bucks. And the one question he posed to them is, can you tell me why I would dedicate the rest of my life to selling soap? And that was the story he used to tell at the kitchen table, which totally shaped who I am and what I value. And then probably the other informative part is all of that traveling. So I've had the great gift of experiencing many different people, many different cultures, and also working across many different industries. I came to the civil service 8 years ago. But before that, I was in television production. I worked for a multimedia agency. I've ran my own business. I've been a consultant. And I love diversity of thought, diversity of talent, and I love the power of what you can achieve when you can bring all of that to the workplace.
A lot of people, when they think government, when they think civil service, technology and digital, then they're not necessarily the first things you think of if that's the career that you're looking to go into. How did you end up in this particular role? I'm assuming you didn't start off in a digital and technology role in government, or did you?
No, I did. So I was living in Australia with my young family and ran an organisation in Australia, which was aimed at supporting young people in their mental health. an organisation called Reach Out. And in that organisation, I was what was called a chief operating officer and was responsible for transforming the whole organisation to be more service focused and more user focused in terms of how we reached young people and delivered to them. And I got the real bug there for digital and transformation and business change and cultural change. And when I came back to the UK, I was shopping around for what are the most interesting and important things happening in the UK that bring all of those passions together. And at the time, the government digital service led by Mike Bracken was this force of change within the civil service. I met a giant of digital and technology, a gentleman called Tom Loosemore, for a coffee. We had a chat, and then I found my way into the government digital service, leading transformation across multiple agencies for what was then the Department for Business. So my way into the civil service was through the government digital service. And then as my time there matured, I really wanted to not just be in the centre of government, but actually have the privilege of working within a major government department to do the do, but from the inside.
I have to say, a bit of advice for listeners who are considering make a career change, asking someone for a cup of coffee, asking them for their time, asking them for a remote cup of tea is really powerful, because not only are you forming those relationships, but you find out stuff that you wouldn't necessarily find out if you just emailed them. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was on a forum yesterday evening. We were talking about the values of the civil service and how is it different from the private sector. Because money isn't the motivator, profit isn't a motivator in the civil service, I think it brings a culture and attracts people who are very generous with their time. And I have been gifted a lot of time from some very brilliant people. And, you know, in the position that I am in now, I want to give that back. So someone reaching out and saying, let's just have a coffee and a chat, I think is incredibly powerful, but can take a bit of bravery, I guess, on the end of the person reaching out, because there's an assumption, isn't there, that, oh, everyone's really busy and these are important and inverted commas people. But I try to make myself as available as I possibly can be to anybody who just fancies a chat. Because as you and I are experiencing now, there's power in conversation and there's power in connection.
Well, I've got my cup of coffee right here. So let's have a look at some of the work that you've been doing over the last 4 years or so. I hear that things started in a basement somewhere, like this digital tech team. Can you tell me a bit more about that and how it's developed?
The legendary basement in Sanctuary Buildings in DfE. So I think the most important thing to say is technology has existed in DfE for many, many years, but digital in terms of digital first service delivery and the skills of user-centered design, you know, software development was new to the DfE approximately 4 years ago. The apprenticeship service is our most mature service within DfE. And as part of machinery of government changes, that service arrived at DfE 4 years ago.
And by service, you mean just anything that helps members of the public achieve a specific goal? We're helping them to do that.
Yes. So the apprenticeship service helps young people find employees in which they can undertake apprenticeships effectively. So going back to the basement, a few individuals from the apprenticeship service arrived in DfE and actually seeded the beginning of where we are now, which is a single digital and technology function. And it's interesting, isn't it, that it has literally started from the bottom up digital. And the basement is a good analogy of where we began and where we are now.
So where are we now? Like, what are some of the things that we're doing now that we weren't doing 4+ years ago?
Gosh, these are good questions. And what I'm struck by as we're talking is the past year working in COVID or through COVID, we have just gone at 100 miles an hour for a year. And so actually even pausing with you this morning and having to cast my mind back 4 years ago feels like it's an opportunity that I haven't had for a really long time is what I'm reflecting on. So where have we come in 4 years? I mean, firstly, it's often really hard to articulate that because change has happened quite organically and incrementally. And it's really hard sometimes to celebrate those successes and see how far you've come because you're so caught up in the present. What I would say is we are constantly maturing. So I think we've gone from digital being seen as something that the organization was relatively wary of to now something that is front and center in our strategic approach about how we're thinking about the future. And clearly, COVID demonstrated the absolute necessity of having a good digital and technology capability within the organisation that can pivot really fast to the demanding and ever-changing needs of our users.
Like one moment kids were in schools, the next moment you're expected to work from home and you might not have a computer, for example.
Right, yeah. So, you know, our technology teams and our technology infrastructure kept us going and working throughout COVID. I mean, on a dime, we went from being in the office, didn't we, to working from home. And it's now just become our new normal, hasn't it? I think COVID, for every organisation, not just for the DfE, has put digital and technology front and centre. It no longer feels like we're having a we need to become more digital conversation. The question is now, what do we need to achieve and how do we need to achieve it? And that's a big mindset shift more than anything else.
I mean, you're right to point out that everybody had to suddenly shift to working from home. But I was specifically pointing out with that question, there were kids as well. There were kids who maybe they had use of a family laptop, but then all of a sudden, maybe even children with quite different ages are having to fight over the family laptop and still get learning. And DfE had to help support that. It's a challenge.
Yeah, it was huge. I mean, we span up what is the biggest delivery of laptops. I don't know if it's in the world, but certainly it's a massive undertaking, 1.4 million laptops shipped to young and vulnerable people so that they continue education. And I think that whole experience has brought us as an organisation and digital and technology in particular much closer to the front line of what's actually happening across the country and the importance of schooling, not just in terms of supporting education for our children, but also in supporting their mental health and their well-being and their connection to their community. So, you know, it sort of reaffirms why you work in the public service when you receive a message from a young person who's just received their laptop and feels connected to their school and their community. It's why you get up in the morning, isn't it, really?
A couple of things we've briefly touched on for the briefest of moments I'd like to hear a bit more about. You mentioned user-centered design, and I know there's this user-centered design lab. But unfortunately, because I started working here during the pandemic, I've not even been into the office. I'm not even sure I would be able to find the office without Google Maps. So tell me, what is this user-centered design lab?
Well, the user-centered design lab is a group of very talented user researchers and user-centered designers who are tasked with ensuring that what we are trying to achieve in the Department for Education, we're doing it with a lens on our users. And when I say users, we should probably start talking more specifically about teachers, school administrators, people working in early years centres, in some instances social workers, people who are working in FE colleges. They use our services. And the end goal of that is improvement to young people and learners. So the user-centered design lab is working with policy colleagues to ensure that whatever policy design or policy outcomes we're looking to achieve as the Department for Education, we're doing it as much as possible with a view on how that policy impacts people in the real world and the options to deliver it effectively.
Policy seems to run through the veins of everything in the DfE. That's understandable, I suppose. But the other thing is service ownership. I wasn't familiar with the service ownership model before I started here, and I'm assuming that will be quite a few listeners who aren't either. So what is it exactly?
So I think what we're trying to achieve with it is introduce this notion of end-to-end service. So end-to-end service is, in my very simple terms, a series of transactions that a user will go through in order to achieve an outcome or a goal. And very often in government, we have been guilty in the past of throwing things incoherently towards a user, and the user has to figure out all the steps that they need to do. So service is about trying to make it really clear and simple for a user about how they achieve their outcome. One of the best examples in government, in my view, is the passport office. It takes you right from how do you apply through to the physical act of going into the building and picking up your passport and so on. So that is, for me, an example of service. Service ownership is about establishing within government a culture of an individual and a team being responsible for the end-to-end experience for the user around a service. And in DfE, we try and blend it as much as possible into a role that combines policy design with the delivery of the service. Because so often, the quality, the efficacy, and the experience of the service is dictated by policy. So what are we trying to achieve? What are the rules that someone has to go through in order to get a passport or a visa, for example? So service ownership is about trying to blend within our culture an individual and team that is responsible for policy and delivery, combining all the skills, commercial, digital, technology and policy design and user-centered experience into a team responsible for that overall outcome.
I think there are some organisations and charities, NGOs, like people who work very much from like a policy basis as well, where it almost feels like the rules, the policy comes first, and then it's like, okay, what can you do to make this happen in the digital and real world? Just before recording this, a new strategy was launched for digital and technology. Can you tell us a bit more about that? What are you hoping to achieve? What's the vision?
So it's worth saying that this strategy or plan or whatever we want to call it really marks the beginning of the first year in which digital and technology are working together as a single team. And I think you said in your intro, digital and technology came together last summer, and we can definitely cover that off in terms of what that's been like and what we've been overcoming and the opportunities that we're now set to take advantage of. I think the purpose of the strategy is to provide a really clear joined up view for our teams around what we hope to achieve in 21-22. And it has kind of four key themes. The first one is we've got to run the business. I mean, technology and our credibility rests on our ability to keep the whole organization running. So that's number one. Number two is continue to respond to the needs of our users and children and learners as we move from what effectively has been a year of crisis response into educational recovery. So what are we learning and what does it mean for the vast numbers of young people who are coming back into full-time physical education and lost learning, as well as impact on mental health? How do we make sure that we support young people moving forward out of crisis? The third one is around what we call raising the bar around our own operational maturity. So we're still maturing. Digital and technology is never a fixed state. We can't stand still ever, because if we do, we're falling behind. So we've got to continuously be investing in our people and our skills and our practices and our ways of working. And then finally, we need to work really hard on what we call reducing burden. So I think it's common language within the DfE to say, you know, what we do clearly impacts the sector. And it's our duty to make sure that the way that we're trying to deliver to the sector is as simple and easy for teachers and school administrators and frontline staff as possible. And then equally within our own organisation to make sure that we can move at speed and take out some of the friction of bureaucracy that can stop us achieving value quickly.
It feels like there's an ambition to be a thought leader in terms of digital and technology there, if I might interpret it a little bit like that. So what would you want other organisations in the public sector to know about the service ownership model if they were considering doing something along those lines? And what would you say to them?
Well, look, the service owner model requires collaboration. At its heart, it's about bringing a melting pot of different teams, perspectives and skills together to deliver that outcome for a teacher. So if I think in the example of one of our key services is, you know, helping teachers find jobs. We got a team who are dedicated towards that, who are a mix of skills from right across the department. And I think this is the big challenge for digital and technology is how do you blend yourself into the organization? Digital shouldn't be something that is other to the organization. It should be embedded at its heart. And so getting to the service ownership model is a collaboration collaboration between myself and policy directors and policy colleagues, as well as commercial and finance colleagues. So it's about bringing people to the table. I don't have full ownership end to end of that service. My job is to bring the digital and technology expertise to it. But I think what I would say is it's organizational change, not just digital and technology. It's how we think about what we deliver and how we deliver and how we measure our performance.
As a side note to that, I have to say, as a product manager, I would love to be in the room at the very start, at the inception of things, when talking about those policies. With digital, we can reimagine this. This could be something drastically different. So it would be quite exciting to kind of see people collaborating from the very beginning of a process.
There's that great quote from Hamilton, that song I love, "You Gotta Be in the Room Where It Happens." Do you know that one?
Yes, I saw Hamilton. I love, actually, all my friends are like, "Adobe, can you stop talking about Hamilton?" I'm like, never.
I love that song. And I think that's a real challenge. If I speak to my fellow CDTOs across government, it's a real challenge getting into the room where it happens.
CDTOs, another thing I've noticed since being in the civil service, people speak in a different language here. Right, that is something I have been wanting to ask you about. It goes back to one of the first things we were talking about, which was changing from 4 people in a basement to, you know, over 100 people and building this reputation amongst the rest of the department that, hey, we're not trying to restrict you. In fact, we want to enable all your dreams to come true. But this is like a culture shift, isn't it? Have you come up against, I imagine you must have done, have you come up against a more traditional view of how services should be created and implemented? And how have you tried to negotiate your way around that?
Yeah, well, I think it's a tightrope walk is the way I describe it, because you've got to be both a challenger within the organisation, prepared to take risks and show what is possible, but you also need to bring the organisation with you. I mean, I think I've definitely been guilty in the past in some instances of sort of saber-rattling, and I don't know if that's the right word, saber-rattling, but what I mean is advocating too strongly and losing people as a result. I really try hard not to talk about the word digital. I really try hard to talk about what is it we're trying to achieve? What is the best way to go about trying to achieve that? And sort of deconstruct, if you like, some of the mythology around digital. And at times I think we're really bad at helping ourselves. I think we speak in a different language. Digital can seem like a dark art or a mysterious art. And I think we are also guilty within the digital community of putting some of that language and barriers around us as well. So a lot of it is about just trying to get people to the table to talk about what is the solution to this problem and bring user-centered design and expertise and product ownership to that question, but to try and neutralize it. Because otherwise, I think certainly at the very beginning of digital in government, there was a perceived notion of us and them. Digital being new and fantastic. And actually, I'm not sure if that helps specifically when it comes to taking a whole organization with you. It requires a degree of impatience to get going and patience to accept that it takes a while for the organization to come around. So I would say that, most of the days I get quite confused. Are we doing enough? Are we going too fast or are we not going slow enough? But it takes time. It takes a lot of time.
I think also just talking to people on a human level and building relationships. I mean, that's harder to do now that we're at home and it's all video chats and things like that. On that subject, how have you coped in terms of managing your mental health at home? There's two aspects to this, I guess. There's like what you're personally doing, and then how exactly do you encourage that in your senior leaders?
If I think about this last year of leading through COVID, it has definitely been the most challenging personal journey in terms of professional working life and also helping to lead others through that. I suffer from anxiety, and I found the crisis at the beginning sent my anxiety like through the roof. I just remember being very triggered and very anxious. So I'm fortunate enough that I can recognize that in myself now, and I have a number of strategies that I put in place to support me. So I gave up drinking. I made sure that I did yoga in the morning, in the evening, and spent as much time as I could off screens when it was available to me. And I think that's really important for me, because I think the job of the leader is to bring positive energy to work. And so if I'm not taking care of myself, how on earth am I able to take care of others? In terms of looking after others, I think I try and lead by example. Part of me sharing what I've just shared with you now is to encourage other people to talk about their mental health, to put in strategies to look after themselves, and to know that it's okay to say, I'm not feeling great today. Being able to share your vulnerability is, for me, a mechanism that I use to help others share theirs, so that we can create a workplace in which we're looking after each other, in which it's okay to say, I'm having a bit of a crap day, or maybe even having a crap week, and for teammates to support and encourage each other. And like you said, I mean, we're meeting each other across an electronic screen this morning, and yet you can still have human connection, can't you? I mean, I'm looking at you and I can feel your energy in this conversation. So I think a job of a leader is to look after their own energy and then to help others manage theirs.
You're not just a CDTO, a Chief Digital and Technology Officer, you're also a mother. How has this last year been on your kids? How's it been being a mother and suddenly a school teacher and trying to do PE lessons in the front room or something?
Look, I'm very fortunate. I mean, the one thing about COVID is it's affected all of us, hasn't it? No one has gotten away without being impacted. I'm really lucky. I've got three healthy children who have managed their own mental health really well throughout COVID. The biggest challenge being my gorgeous 17-year-old son. Frankly, I think it's been really tough on teenagers. I'm lucky because I know that it's impacted friends and family, and I'm a governor of my local primary schools. I know and experience the impact that it's had on other families. So I would say overall, we're in pretty good shape.
I think you've mentioned before that your son is mixed race, is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't want to end our discussion without mentioning everything that's happening in the world in terms of George Floyd. As a black woman myself, it feels like there was a world before George Floyd's murder and there was a world after it. I know how it's been like for me and all of my black friends and family, but what is it like as the mother of someone who is a mixed race? Did you have to have certain conversations? I mean, what was your experience like? I don't want to assume anything.
I will share with you two experiences. So one, on the personal front, I have a brown-skinned boy who was electrified by George Floyd's murder and brought a new level of discussion around race to the family dinner table, no question. And then at work, George Floyd opened up a conversation around race, which we were having in terms of inclusion and diversity, but I don't think we'd really, truly scratched below the surface of. What started off as very difficult, but ended up in a really open, inquiring place around race within the civil service. And what I learned through that experience as a leader is it's my responsibility to make sure that black and brown voices are at the center of all the conversations we're having around race and inclusion and diversity. And that actually I have a role to make sure that I enable those who may not feel naturally confident to voice their experience, to give them the space and the safety to do so. So this is a long journey we're on, right? There are no easy answers, but I'm committed to making a difference and to using whatever small influence and power I have to ensure that our workplace is one that is fair and open for everybody.
Thank you very much for sharing that. That means a lot to me. I know it would mean a lot to our listeners too.
Across Digital and Technology, we have the Race Working Group, which is a brilliant bunch of individuals who are really committed to ensuring that we stay vigilant and we take action. I have a race mentor, an individual who I speak with every fortnight.
You have a race mentor?
Yeah.
What's that about then?
I've got the lovely, I hope she doesn't mind if I say her name, Lindsay Williams, who we sit and chat every fortnight around what's going on and how's it feeling. And I think one of the things that I've learned is, you know, we can talk about inclusion and diversity in the metrics, but really it comes down to how are people feeling in the workplace? You know, do they feel seen, recognized, supported? Does it feel fair? So I really work with her on what more can I do? But she also sort of plugs me into and grounds me in what people thinking and feeling. And we're going to launch together a new initiative where we're going to have people come and spend time with me and follow me around. And we'll have a conversation at the end. There is no secret sauce when it comes to being a leader. And hopefully by opening up what it means to be in a senior position, it makes it more accessible for people to aspire to that position themselves.
Thank you so much, Emma. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you, listeners, too, for joining us on this journey. We hope that you got a lot out today, and we've got so many topics that we want to talk about and delve into. Next time on Think Digital, Act Human, we'll be speaking to Black Colly about their experience of DfE Digital and Technology. We heard from Emma some of the things that the department's put in place to start talking about race and start sharing Black experiences, but we also want to hear some Black voices and hear what they've got to say about the matter. So that's going to be on our next pod. We hope you'll join us. You'll bring your own cup of coffee and we'll have a good time. Many thanks to Emma Stace once again, and thanks to the producers of the podcast, Rosie Roth and Louise Mullen, and the show creator, Nettie Williams. Thanks a lot. Bye.